This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Sea ice loss around Antarctica is just one of the mega-scale changes down there as we heat up the planet. For the overview and the latest, we go to a well-known expert in the field. We hear a lot about change in the Arctic, but not Antarctica. Yet the South Pole holds many world-scale risks and its own unique tipping points. In just one example, sea level rise from melting Antarctic glaciers could flood major coastal cities and delta croplands around the world. Dr. Matt King is director at the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. He is a professor at the University of Tasmania. We last spoke in December 2024. That was before the voyage of a research ship to the South Pole and before dozens of papers this year on Antarctica, many by Australian researchers. From Hobart, Tasmania, Matt King, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
We thought the South Pole was a slow-changing giant. Tell us about new science warning about abrupt changes already happening there.
Yeah, well, Alex, it's not just you who thought Antarctica was a slow-changing giant. I mean, it was very widely held until the 1990s or the 2000s that was pretty much the case, that Antarctica slowly changed, maybe over centuries or millennia, and that we've been proved to be wrong. Antarctica has demonstrated very clearly to us, as the more we've been able to observe it from space and in the field, we've seen that the Antarctic ice sheet and the Southern Ocean can change very rapidly in ways that we're only really just starting to get a handle on. And so abrupt change has begun to emerge. You know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of abrupt change is the collapse of the Larsen B ice shelf in 2002. So this is a floating extension of the glaciers flowing through the Antarctic Peninsula. They come out and hit the ocean and they start floating and they form this ice shelf. It splintered into thousands of icebergs in the course of just 6 weeks. That was captured from space. We could see this unfolding. It was a very dramatic event. It was certainly abrupt, and it was persistent and sustained. And as a result of that, the glaciers that were feeding into it sped up by a factor of 2 to 6. And then over the next decade or so, some of those glaciers lowered by 300 meters, 400 meters. And so there's very dramatic change. But more recently, we've seen abrupt change in the Antarctic sea ice. That's the frozen ocean around Antarctica. It was very steady for all the way back to the beginning of the first satellite observations in the late 1970s. Very steady, maybe even slightly increasing in the years up to 2017. And then it fell off a cliff. We lost huge areas of sea ice and they haven't been fully recovered. And this year, again, is sort of near record low levels. And so it seems like we've entered, very abruptly entered a new phase, a new regime. And we've also seen other things on land, like the greening of the Antarctic Peninsula as glaciers and ice retreats in those areas. We're seeing vegetation quite rapidly, habitat areas that were formerly glaciated. And we're seeing very rapid changes in those areas of ocean species, penguins, moving southward as the warmer waters come in from the north.
So much happening, and most of us know about the dangerous weakening of the Gulf Stream that warms the East Coast, the UK, Scandinavia. The movie The Day After Tomorrow popularized all that if it were to shut down suddenly. But a major current in the Southern Ocean conveyor belt has already almost stopped around Antarctica. Could you talk to us about what's going on there?
Yeah, well, I mean, that Day After Tomorrow movie actually starts with the last of the ice shelf, and so it actually starts off with that very thing I was just discussing. But there are big changes going on in the Southern Ocean that have global ramifications. The oceans are made up of a series of conveyor belts that transport heat and nutrients and oxygen from the high latitudes or the deep ocean to the equatorial regions and then up into the northern hemisphere and then sinks down deep and comes back again. It really is a global conveyor belt. And, of course, that movement of heat affects the planet's climate. The movement of nutrients and oxygen sustains global ocean marine life. And what's been observed just in the last 2 years or 3 years is a 20% reduction in the Antarctic component of that global overturning circulation. At least part of that has been driven by the melting of land ice, or the increased melting of land ice from Antarctica. And that's been interfering with the ability of dense waters to sink to the bottom and sort of sustain this, the Antarctic part of that conveyor belt. Sea ice has also played a role in that, in another part of Antarctica where changes to formation of sea ice has also affected the rate of sinking of surface waters down to the depths, and again that's part of that global conveyor belt. So we've seen a slowdown. What's perhaps even more concerning is that the best model projections we have suggest that we would expect more, maybe a 40% slowdown in the coming decades. But two, those models suggest that the slowdown we're seeing now shouldn't have occurred yet. So it's happening faster than the models project. And so we've got work to do on making the models more realistic. But, there are alarm bells ringing in the south. And these things don't stay in Antarctica. They have global ramifications.
Yes, the future of the southern ocean ice still seems a bit uncertain. One headline this summer said, southern ocean salinity may be triggering sea ice loss. I wonder, does that solve the mystery of why Antarctic sea ice was growing until about 2012, 2014, and then pulled back precipitously?
So I think what we're seeing in terms of trying to understand what's going on with Antarctic sea ice is still very much in the healthy scientific debate. It seems clear that the ocean has played a major role, and something has changed in the ocean that's causing the change in patterns of sea ice and the spatial variation of those changes, because it's not happening the same everywhere. And so I think at the moment we're seeing in the literature various ideas being put forward about what the mechanisms are, how it relates to broader scale climate change or climate variability. And so I think we're still very much in the process of trying to understand it, having been caught very much by surprise when this really started kicking off in 2017 and then much more dramatically in 2023. Probably the truth is there's a bunch of different things going on, but we'll need to wait until we see how the science plays out to really understand the drivers of this, and hence have a good understanding or a better understanding of how that might change in the future. Because the next step, what happens next is the key. Because this is not just a sort of like a scientific curiosity. We've talked about the role of sea ice in global ocean circulation and climate and ocean life. But as you melt that sea ice back, you're replacing all that beautiful white snow-covered sea ice with dark ocean, so it absorbs more heat. And there's another feedback that actually, as the ice melts away, the ocean warms more, melts more ice. And so these things have great scientific interest, but they're also hugely societal importance. That's an energy balance.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Matt King, a leader in Australian and Antarctic climate science. Matt, tell us about this year's ship-based expedition of scientists to Antarctica. Were there surprises? Do you expect more science to come out of that as results are studied?
Yeah, look, this was a very exciting voyage for Australian researchers, especially, Alex, because it was the maiden science voyage for our new icebreaker called Noina, funded by the Australian federal government. It had replaced our previous icebreaker that had worked tirelessly for 30 years or so. And then there's been a gap while this new icebreaker was sort of commissioned and tested and finally headed off to the Antarctic, to the Denman Glacier, which is a remarkable glacier that most people have never heard of. But on its own, it holds enough ice to raise global sea levels by 1.5 meters. So just one glacier. So you think about standing on the edge of the ocean, a slightly short woman might be 1.5 meters tall. Just think about what would take to fill up the global oceans by that height of a person. That's this one glacier system. Now, that's not going to melt, anytime soon, but it is changing. There's signs of retreat of this glacier, acceleration of this glacier, but people have hardly studied it. you know, the area in front of it on the continental shelf was literally unmapped. The amount of work going on the glacier has been very limited indeed. And so last year we had a team of people from Australia's university sector, particularly working on the glacier itself, on land and onto the ice. And then this year we had the complementary voyage where we could finally get the icebreaker in, start to map some of those areas, start to map the ocean and its properties, map the seafloor, understand what biological life is going on, which has an important role in absorption of carbon dioxide. And so the team went in there. There were 60 researchers on board, and it was really quite remarkable. They had to go slightly later than we wanted to, so they arrived there in March, and that's when the period in Antarctica when the sea ice, the frozen ocean, is starting to form again. It melts back in the summer, a long way back into the coastline, almost always all the way to the coastline in many locations, and then it starts to form again. And sea ice makes it hard just to get around, even though you've got an icebreaker. It slows things down and makes some areas very difficult to get to. There was concern that the area we were trying to get to would be jammed up with sea ice. And as it turned out, there was almost no sea ice to be seen this current season. We don't know if that's part of the broader picture of sea ice or if that was just this area just happened to be, you know, luckily low. But the ship got in, mapped huge areas of the continental shelf, collected seafloor samples, a whole bunch of cores from the seafloor mud, which tells us about the past climate over the last thousands to tens of thousands or longer years. We're looking for significant changes in seafloor topography that might have indicated the glaciers were much bigger in the past. We didn't see a lot of variation on the seafloor there, so that was a bit of a surprise. We saw marine life where we wouldn't have expected marine life to be. So, you know, there were a bunch of surprises, but the work is still being worked up, and it will probably take 5 years at least for the bulk of it to come out. And then there will still be legacy for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, especially when you're talking about, well, we actually now know what the shape of the seafloor looks like. That'll go into computer models that will be thinking about how do you get warm ocean water to the ice sheet. And so the benefits of this voyage will be out forever.
That's fantastic stuff. Fantastic for scientists and great for all of us who are trying to understand this world. How much does change in Antarctica affect weather in Australia? Does it?
Yeah, so one of the first reasons why Australia got into the Antarctic, you know, fieldwork business back in the early 1900s was for weather observations. And some of the most valuable weather observations for Australian forecasting come from the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic. And so there are occasions where you can see from a satellite image a low-pressure system sitting over the Southern Ocean between Antarctica and Australia, and you see this swirling cloud spiral sitting there, and the southern tip of the low-pressure system will be touching the Antarctic coastline, and the northern tip will be projecting into Australia. And so what goes on in the Antarctic and the Southern Ocean has a very strong impact on Australia's broader climate and also impacts on our rainfall and drought, although we don't have as much information as we need yet about what change in the Antarctic will do to Australia's weather and climate. And so that's something that we're trying to work on more. Flipping it the other way, there's some very interesting work that's been done here in Australia over a number of years where they've recognised a correlation between the snowfall rate or the deposition of salts in an ice core in coastal Antarctica with that correlates with rainfall rates on the east coast of Australia, where most of Australia's population lives. And the thing is that the ice core goes back 1,000 or 2,000 years. And so they've been able to look and see that there are indications of multiple decade-long droughts on the eastern coast of Australia that were never known from observational records. And so it's informing on, you know, water resource management, the idea that there could be a 3 or 4 decade severe drought in East Antarctica, even without an altered climate, just for the natural variability. It's sort of sobering, and that information is coming out of Antarctica because the two are linked.
As everyone knows, climate science funded by the U.S. federal government has been slashed. The U.S. intends to dock its only U.S. Antarctic research icebreaker. Other countries may have to pick up that slack. China has been funding and producing a lot of new science on climate and Earth systems. The Chinese built two bases in Antarctica. How do you see China's activity at the South Pole, Matt?
China's definitely interested in science, and we've seen that with a very dramatic rise in publication from Chinese researchers. Their output's tripled from 2017 to 2024, while the Western nations, the U.S., Britain, and Australia declined by, you know, the U.S. declined by 20% over a decade. There was a COVID blip where more people published things, but there's sort of long-term negative trends amongst some of the key players in the West, and China's been ramping up that activity. A lot of that growth has come from probably computer lab-based or remote sensing activities that don't depend on field work, but they are obviously ramping up their ability to do field work in the Antarctic as well. And so China, like every other nation, is interested in science, but they're also interested, like every other nation, in geopolitics. And so both of those things are going on here, I've got no doubt. We're keen to continue to work with our Chinese research colleagues who are doing great research and in order to accelerate the work we're doing. But we also need all the other nations to actually be coming to the table and not decelerating, but accelerating, especially in the face of all these surprises and abrupt changes that are emerging. So we desperately need the US to change course. We need the UK and Australia to invest more and in order to get ahead of these surprises that are coming at us.
And as you've written about, New Zealand is pulling back a little from their Antarctic research program.
Well, I mean, I think all the nations are struggling at the moment with station rebuilds. So a lot of the infrastructure at the Antarctic stations, and so New Zealand, Australia's the same. The US, you know, they built a lot of these infrastructures in the 1970s and 80s, and they're sort of reaching end of life, and they're out of date in terms of modern safety standards and compliance and energy efficiency, and so they're expensive to run. And so you can understand why nations are sort of focusing perhaps the budget on those, but that does come at the detriment, and those sorts of rebuilding activities can take, you know, 5 years. And so you set back 5 years in a time of dramatic change where we need to get information. So, you know, we do think that you know, infrastructure is important, but the infrastructure is there for the science, and so we need to keep on pushing the science out there and actually continuing to accelerate that. And so, yeah, we do need nations to step up in this regard and see just how dramatic the changes are and just how important those changes are to everyone.
Do you think it's possible the vast Southern Ocean could delay the worst effects of climate change in the Southern Hemisphere due to the lag time between ocean heating versus land heating?
Well, we certainly are seeing that the Southern Ocean already is delaying the impacts of climate change, because the Southern Ocean absorbs huge amounts of carbon dioxide, huge amounts of heat. And if the Southern Ocean wasn't doing that, that heat would be in the atmosphere and that carbon dioxide would be in the atmosphere. And I think it's something of the order of 12% of all human emissions have been absorbed by the Southern Ocean. So, you know, that's an enormous amount of carbon dioxide. Of course, that does, you know, the heat that's being absorbed by the Southern Ocean does mean that the heat's not in the atmosphere impacting on the broader climate. But ultimately, that heat then will come to bear on marine life and the future of the ice sheet. So that heat's being stored up, but it's going to have an impact in the climate system, and we're starting to see that now. So, yes, the Southern Ocean is something we should value. I was involved in a piece of work that actually just put a number on that absorption of carbon dioxide. And if you price that at European values, it's $180 billion US dollars a year worth of carbon that's being absorbed by the Southern Ocean. And if the Southern Ocean wasn't doing it, that job, would have to find that $180 billion a year from other parts of the global economy.
So you're the director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. What will be the focus for your unit now?
Yeah, so we're one of those organisations that's actually facing a funding cliff. Our funding is due to taper to zero at the middle of next year. We're talking to government about, you know, sustained funding for Antarctic university-based research, which drives about 80% of Australia's activities, either leading it or supporting it in one way or another. So there's a huge piece of work that's sort of funded on short-term, you know, not fully coordinated activity. And so we think there needs to be consolidated, coordinated, and sustained funding for the university sector so we can drive more of the research forward. So we're looking at sort of tapering down, and we'll be looking to wrap up all of our research as best we can, but at the same time trying to convince government to go, well, we can't stop this, we need to keep going. And so we're having those conversations with our elected officials, and, you know, they're very receptive to that, especially here in Tasmania where, you know, Antarctic research really matters. And so, you know, we're hoping to get the ear of the relevant minister in government and the federal government, that they might actually continue to support the work that we're doing, but in a better way going forward, with greater coordination.
As we wrap up here, is there any other new study or research that you would like to talk about?
I think we talked about abrupt change, but I think the paper that came out in Nature last week, which was led by largely by an Australian group of researchers, including those in my centre, that was a tremendous piece of work because we saw the degree of not just the changes but the interconnectedness of the system. And that isn't always fully appreciated, that actually the change in one part of the system can have cascading effects into other parts of the system. But the other thing I got from that paper as well is just that actually the tipping points, the abrupt sustained changes in the Antarctic, may be in some cases more severe than previously thought, and maybe more severe than the Arctic. So the sea ice in the Arctic has often been thought as a tipping point. There's some questions around that because there might be a recoverability there once climate has stabilized. But it seems like the Antarctic sea ice may not have a recoverability, at least not for centuries. And so that was pretty surprising to me. And again, another piece of sobering information that the changes that are going on now might have not sort of decades of impact, but centuries of impact. And so, you know, we've got to pay attention to that and act in a similarly abrupt way to respond in terms of mitigating climate warming.
Abrupt climate action needed. From Hobart, Tasmania, we have been speaking with Professor Matt King. You can find links to all the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt King, thank you for helping our listeners on Radio EcoShock.
It was great to be with you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.